KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Some of President-elect Trump's cabinet picks go through Senate confirmation hearings this week. It's a public job interview. How many, if any, will have a tough time getting confirmed? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Brooke Shields has been modeling and acting for almost 60 years, pretty much her whole life. I'm Steve Inske.
Jeremy Martinez, Leila Fadel asked her about her new memoir titled Brooke Shields is Not Allowed to Get Old. Also, we'll hear about how older residents of Los Angeles had a much more difficult time trying to evacuate from the fires and tracking the evolution of an extinct animal's fierce teeth. It's Monday, January 13th. 4 years ago, Donald Trump was impeached for incitement of insurrection. First time a U.S. president was impeached twice. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. In Los Angeles, stronger winds are in the forecast for the next 72 hours. That could complicate efforts by fire crews to contain the major fires that continue to burn in and around the city. Steve Futterman reports 24 people have been killed.
It is the one thing people here do not want. The increased winds will continue for the next 3 days. The strongest are forecast to come late Tuesday into Wednesday. Because of the threat, fire crews are being pre-positioned in areas thought to be vulnerable. Ryan Chadwick is in the Mandeville Canyon area.
Fire's obviously continuing to go, but we're keeping it contained, keeping it away from the houses. From here, right now, things are looking good around these homes.
As strong as these winds will be, they are not expected to be nearly equal to the tremendously strong winds last week. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
California Governor Gavin Newsom says he has already ordered work to begin on fire recovery. More than 12,000 structures have been damaged or lost in the L.A. blazes. Investigators are evaluating the structure before debris removal begins. The governor says he estimates it will take between 6 and 9 months to remove all the fire wreckage. Negotiations continue in Qatar to try to reach a ceasefire deal in Gaza. Representatives from Israel, Hamas, and the U.S. are in close proximity in Qatar reviewing proposals. The outgoing Biden administration and members of the incoming Trump administration are working together on the issues. NPR's Daniel Estrin says they both want some kind of agreement reached before Biden leaves office.
I spoke with an official with knowledge of the ongoing talks who's not authorized to speak publicly, but who said Trump's team has told Israel that by the inauguration, they want either a deal or a declaration of principles, which would be some kind of document that would, you know, lock the sides into a commitment toward a deal.
NPR's Daniel Estrin reporting. Stocks open mixed this morning as oil prices jump. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 140 points in early trading.
Oil prices jumped sharply over the weekend after the Biden administration added new sanctions against Russia's energy sector. The benchmark for U.S. crude topped $78 a barrel. So far, the higher crude prices have not filtered down to the gas pump. AAA says regular gas is selling for an average of just over $3.06 a gallon, little change from a week ago. U.S. Steel has gotten a little more time to cancel its planned sale to Japan's Nippon Steel. President Biden moved to block that sale, citing national security concerns, but an interagency committee agreed to delay the effective date of that order until mid-June. Stock in U.S. Steel rose on the news. The company still hoped to salvage the deal. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 142 points. The NASDAQ is down 230. This is NPR. The U.S. Geological Survey says an earthquake hit southeastern Japan today with a magnitude of 6.9. Japanese authorities issued a tsunami advisory, but there are no immediate reports of damage. Japanese officials say they're going to investigate to see if this tremor could be linked to its warning last year for the potential of a megaquake. Canada's Foreign Affairs Minister says she is considering all options when it comes to countermeasures against terrorists threatened by President-elect Trump. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, that's the message Canadian leaders will take to Washington next week.
During an interview with CTV News, Foreign Affairs Minister Melanie Joly was asked if she would cut off energy exports to the U.S. in response to tariffs. Joly said, quote, everything is on the table, adding it's a conversation she would have with Republican decision makers. Canada's leaders say Trump's threat of a 25% tariff on Canadian products would be devastating for the economies of both countries. Some premiers are against cutting off energy exports to retaliate. The premiers are to meet with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau this week to formulate a Canadian response to the tariffs. Joly says she's calling on every political leader in Canada to be on board because this is no time for division. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
The world's largest religious gathering has begun in Prayagraj, India. Over the next 6 weeks, nearly 400 million Hindus will join the Maha Kumbh festival. Many will conduct ritual bathing in the confluence of three rivers, including the Ganges. This Hindu festival is held once about every 12 years. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Lemelson Foundation, dedicated to improving lives through invention, innovation, and climate action. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantsFDN.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Coming up, why did evolution eliminate the saber-toothed tiger? Scientists look for clues in the teeth.
First, though, California's governor is looking to rebuild the parts of Metro Los Angeles swept away by wildfire.
Gavin Newsom says he wants to restore neighborhoods as quickly as possible. And for people restoring their homes, he will use his power to waive California's famously challenging environmental reviews. First, though, the fires have to burn out, and they have killed an estimated 24 people, so far as we know.
We're joined now by NPR's Adrian Florido in Los Angeles. Adrian, firefighters made some progress containing these fires over the weekend. How are things looking now?
Well, things are looking better. Firefighters are gradually containing the Eaton Fire in northeast L.A. And the Palisades Fire on the west side. Each of those fires destroyed thousands of homes, as you said. They are now burning mostly in the unpopulated hills, but they are still spreading. There were new evacuation orders over the weekend in neighborhoods that the fires were approaching. The big concern now is that winds are, as you said, about to pick up again. There could be gusts as high as 70 miles per hour in some areas. This is L.A. County Fire Chief Anthony Maroney.
These winds, combined with low humidities and low fuel moistures, will keep the fire threat in all of Los Angeles County very high.
L.A. City Fire Chief Kristen Crowley pleaded with residents to stay alert and to stay informed.
Follow all evacuation warnings and orders, and the key here is without delay.
The National Weather Service, A, has warned that critical fire weather conditions will last through Wednesday.
Okay, now, you know, last week we heard a lot about how there aren't enough firefighters or other resources to get these fires under control. So do officials now have what they need?
Well, they're now saying that they are staffed and equipped to handle this. Thousands of firefighters have come in from other states, from Mexico and from Canada, and are working the fire lines. The governor of California called up 1,000 more National Guard troops to help. Dozens of planes and choppers have been dropping water and flame retardant pretty much around the clock. Of course, as we saw last week, a wind and the embers that it carries are what really bring a lot of uncertainty.
Now, as far as the communities that have been hit the hardest, that's Pacific Palisades and Altadena. What's going on there?
Well, people there are just starting to take stock of all that they've lost and what comes next for them. For the most part, these communities are still off limits, even to residents, because investigators are going through with cadaver dogs to search for possible victims. LA County is also saying that before debris cleanup can start in these communities, either by county crews or homeowners themselves, that hazmat teams are going to have to go through parcel by parcel to remove toxic waste. At a community meeting yesterday in Altadena, LA's Public Works Director Mark Pastrella said county officials are already hearing from people asking when they can get in and start rebuilding, but he said it's way too soon. He did promise that officials are working to streamline the cleanup process and also the construction permitting process that's going to be ahead for a lot of people.
We intend to make this as fast as possible to rebuild your homes.
In the meantime, people are scrambling to find temporary housing and also to figure out whether they're covered by their insurance policies.
Now, Adrian, my son and granddaughters had to evacuate to my house, even though they're not from an area that has burned. And they're not going back anytime soon, I don't imagine. But have any people have been allowed to return?
Well, a lot of people in the areas that were under mandatory evacuation orders have not gone back. And the county fire chief said that the conversation about when they will be allowed to return won't start before Thursday. Officials want to be sure that those evacuated communities are no longer at risk of catching fire because these fires are still burning not too far away. Those Santa Ana winds are still blowing also, and Los Angeles is still in an active emergency.
All right, that's NPR's Adrian Florido. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
This week here in Washington, some of President-elect Trump's cabinet nominees hold public job interviews. His choices to lead the Departments of Justice, State, and Defense face Senate confirmation hearings. That would be Pam Bondi for Attorney General, Marco Rubio for Secretary of State, and Pete Hegseth for Secretary of Defense. The Senate Republican leader, John Thune, told Fox News that Democrats should fall in line.
I'm hoping that they will come to their senses and realize that the election drubbing that they took was a message from the American people.
Jessica Taylor of the Cook Political Report is following the hearings, and we're happy you're back with us. Jessica, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
So he mentions Democrats there, but aren't there also some Republicans who had serious questions about some of the nominees?
Yeah, I'm especially watching, on the Hegseth nomination, Iowa Senator Joni Ernst, so she's herself a combat veteran. Typically, these nominees get confirmed, even sometimes with bipartisan support. Even, Hillary Clinton got all but two Republican votes when she was confirmed as Secretary of State for Barack Obama. We haven't had a nominee go down since John Tower for Secretary of Defense and the George H.W. Bush administration. Typically, these nominees face public pressure, see the writing on the wall, and withdraw in the same way that Matt Gaetz did. But a lot of the things that sort of doomed Tower were questions about alcoholism and womanizing. And so Hegseth has a lot of those same questions. So he seems to be the one that I think, is clearly going to be front and center there. And then, someone like Ernst, she could face a primary challenge. She's up for re-election this year if she doesn't sort of fall in line and support them. Other senators I'm watching are the sort of the two Republican centrists, Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. They're a little bit more inoculated from primary challenges. It's not clear who would challenge Collins, even though she's up for re-election this year.
Yeah.
Murkowski, she has a ranked choice all-party primary voting system. And then sort of new senators like John Curtis from Utah, who just took Mitt Romney's post. So he doesn't have to face voters for another 6 years. But Ernst is one I'm really focusing on in that Hegseth nomination.
Let me just work through this. You point out that it's very rare to just vote a nominee down. But in watching this over the years, I realized it's much more of a dance. You mentioned that people might withdraw if things look bad. And then there are also private meetings before the public hearings where senators try to get people on the record, even get them to change their positions. Hasn't that been happening with another controversial nominee, Tulsi Gabbard, who is the nominee for Director of National Intelligence?
Yeah, she does seem to have, you know, we had over the weekend a Republican holdout. Oklahoma Senator James Lankford said that he would vote for her. There were concerns about her backing a key foreign surveillance thing.
Section 702, yeah, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Go on, go on.
Yes, and then you know, she has a lot of concerns about her past relationship with now deposed Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad. So she is doing that. And then, you know, the person who is... She's held a lot of votes with these Republicans, but, you know, John Fetterman has emerged as sort of the, you know, iconoclastic Democrat that has met with some of these more controversial nominees, and we'll see where he votes. He could be one that switches sides.
Okay, I'm just looking up now. As we're talking, it happens that Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s picture flashed up on one of the televisions here in Studio 31, which makes me wonder, as you look ahead, is it certain that every one of these nominees is going to be confirmed?
I don't think it's certain. You know, it is sort of that trio of Hegseth and Gabbard and then Robert F. Kennedy. You mentioned sort of, Senator, as I'm looking at the hearings, Bill Cassidy, who chairs the Senate Health Committee, he already has a primary challenge because he voted for conviction in Trump's impeachment trial, his second impeachment trial. So I'm really watching to see how that nomination for Robert F. Kennedy goes as well. So it's really these three. I expect other ones like Marco Rubio to easily get confirmed with bipartisan support.
And of course, Pam Bondi would be controversial under other circumstances, but she's the backup choice after Gates went away. So
exactly.
Favored to get confirmed. Jessica, thanks so much for your insights. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Jessica Taylor is Senate and Governor's Editor for the Cook Political Report.
Sometimes we have a news story asking, whatever happened to that celebrity? Well, this is a story of a celebrity animal. Researchers are asking, whatever happened to the saber-toothed tiger? Kids learn in school about those tigers with canine teeth, the long pointy ones, which make them look pretty fearsome. Now, they were also really effective for biting, and they evolve multiple times as conditions change. Now, that leads to a mystery. If those teeth were so effective, why did the tigers go extinct? Here's NPR's Jonathan Lambert.
Generally speaking, canine teeth have two main jobs.
They need to be sharp enough to puncture and slice things. But on the other hand, they need to be strong enough to avoid breakage when they're doing that job.
That's paleontologist Emily Rayfield of the University of Bristol. Saber teeth, an extreme canine, are so long and pointy that they're a bit of a conundrum, she says. They seem so lethal, but also fragile. To understand how saber teeth balance that trade-off, the team analyzed nearly 100 different canines, from saber-toothed cats to panda bears. First, they estimated their strength using engineering computer models.
So whereas you can do this for cars and bridges, you can also do it for teeth.
Then, for puncturability, they created stainless steel models of the teeth that bit down into a gel.
It's kind of like a really stiff jello. And you can imagine that really sharp teeth don't need much force to go through the gel, whereas really blunt teeth need a lot of force to go through the gel.
Combined, these two methods revealed the relative strength and puncture performance of all these teeth. Saber teeth came out on top for puncturing.
They'd all evolved towards this kind of shape, which made them really good at puncturing, but to the point where they were actually as good as they could be to resist breakage. So any increase in resisting breakage would mean their puncture performance would get worse.
That specialization led to huge advantages in capturing prey, which is likely why these teeth evolved so many times. For example, it helped saber-toothed cats become an apex predator of the Pleistocene. But the results, published in the journal Current Biology, suggest it also could have been their downfall.
It made us think about whether they'd actually kind of reached a sort of pinnacle in performance that meant that when the environment changed or when there were new predators on the scene, like humans, for example, these animals were simply not able to adapt and change.
Saber-toothed predators are now all gone, so saber teeth could represent a cautionary tale of evolution. Getting too good at one thing just might lead to extinction. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
President-elect Donald Trump's pick to lead the Pentagon, Pete Hegseth, faces questions from lawmakers tomorrow. Now, the grilling is likely to get heated. The former Fox News host has faced accusations of sexual assault and has limited management experience. He is unlikely to obtain Democratic votes, and some moderate Republicans have also expressed reservations. Tune in tomorrow for a preview and updates on the public confirmation hearing. And listen on your smart speaker or just say your local station by name. This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, comedian Roy Wood Jr. His new comedy special, Lonely Flowers, looks at how isolation has sent society spiraling into a culture full of guns, rude employees, self-checkout lanes, and sex parties. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From the Kresge Foundation, established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at kresge.org. From Arm, with the new podcast series, Tech Unheard, Arm CEO Renee Haas talks to tech company leaders like Mike Gallagher from Titletown Tech, who are working to help shape the future of computing. Available on all podcast platforms. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Maybe you remember Brooke Shields as the face of Calvin Klein Jeans, the sexually exploited child in Pretty Baby, or the funny lead in the sitcom Suddenly Susan.
People want you to be the way they remembered you when you mattered to them in a different way, whether they saw your movie or they liked your television show or they had your picture up or something that's very personal to them.
But today, Brooke Shields is a grown woman, and at 59, she's out with a book on this new era in her life. It's called Brooke Shields is Not Allowed to Get Old, and it was inspired by a slight at a party when she revealed her age to the man hosting the evening.
The person's demeanor changed instantly.
In what way?
You know, they said, oh, I wish you didn't say that. I was just like, you wish I didn't say what? Like, told you my age?
She says she's not going to let the world make her feel invisible because she had the gall to get older. And as a businesswoman and entertainer today, she's got a message for women of all ages. And just to let you know, there is some bleeped profanity in this conversation.
I mean, I have two young women daughters, you know, 18 and 21. And, you know, I joke about it, like my knees are practically down to my ankles, you know, at this point. And everything on them is like high and pert and taut and peachy. And, you know, and you're just like, God, wow. Oh. And then, you know, you get a glimpse at yourself in the mirror and you're like, oh boy, okay. And you got to be careful that you don't make that so negative in your life that you start thinking you're less than.
Yeah.
And I don't want to just look great for 59. I just want to look great because I feel great and because I got my roots done yesterday. Like, I think that's a healthy way of treating one's ego, you know?
Yeah.
Do the things that make you feel the best about yourself, but then admit, I don't want to look like my daughters. I've grown up into this person, this body, this face, and this whole person has done a lot and seen a lot and survived a lot and lived through a lot. And my painting has gotten more defined.
There is a line that stuck with me. You write, who knew in a career where I started as a prostitute at age 11, where I played a mother at age 15, that valuing myself at 59 would be my most provocative choice.
You know, to last this long in my industry is definitely not the norm. But when you look at how people react to me, there's been controversy surrounding me since a very, very early age.
Yeah.
But this strength, it started when I went to college because getting an education made me more formidable. And that was not reacted well to by the press because they couldn't push me around as much. Now at this age, there's more of me to contend with because I don't have the same depth of insecurities that I used to. I don't roll over so easily and I don't apologize.
I mean, you started in Hollywood at 11 years old. You were being questioned by the press about whether your mother was doing a good job, about your measurements. You lived through sexual assault. First of all, do you think people just assume you've just lived this beautiful, charmed life because you are beautiful and in the public eye?
Well, I mean, I think that we do that to people and actresses and models, and it's part of what we project. You know, it's part of our job to create fantasy, and people want to escape into that and they want to dream. But I also think my trials or tribulations, they were played out on a larger scale just because they were witnessed by people. But if we really just all look at how hard it is just to get to this age, I think we'd be surprised, like, how much we've all lived through.
Yeah.
I highlight mine just because I want to say, like, come on, you guys, you've all gone through too.
Yeah.
It's no worse or better. And I think that when we start kind of normalizing how hard it is to just be a woman and go through everything and reach this, then I think we'll start patting ourselves on the back a little bit more. And saying, like, hey, that's pretty great. It's cool. Look at what you've survived, you know? Look how you've chosen not to be a victim.
Do you ever wish you had been more angry or more righteous in moments? I mean, thinking about this one particular moment you write about where you go in for a medical procedure and you come out and the male surgeon's like, I also gave you a rejuvenation that you didn't ask for while you were knocked out. Which is what? Ugh. And you never sue him. You didn't really go after him.
I didn't. I think I...
It's a morning show. I don't know if we talk about vaginas on the morning show.
I don't know
show,
if
but
we can say labia, but it's, you know, it's the big dirty word. I think I wasn't strong enough. I didn't feel secure enough in my career for it to yet again be about my anatomy, you know, and I just didn't want it talked about again. Like, I finally felt like I was past being defined by my virginity, you know.
Right.
I don't know if it's about anger. I think it's my shock and my disappointment was so acute, but it felt so familiar. It just felt like, oh, here we go again. This is what's going to happen again. You know, I don't know why you think it's going to be any different, Brooke. That was something I had to sort of grow into, being able to say, like, this is like, if I have a seizure, it's not because I was worried about my salt intake for dietary reasons. You wouldn't ask a man that.
Which is what happened to you. You had a seizure and someone was like, oh, are you trying to lose weight? Is that why this happened?
Yeah. And they probably would have said to a man, like, oh, are you training for a triathlon and you didn't have electrolytes? Because you're an Iron Man? No, they asked me about my dietary restrictions.
What would 59-year-old Brooke Shields tell 11-year-old Brooke Shields if you could today say something to her?
I think you are going to be just fine. You are going to be okay. And you, as you, are enough. You are enough as a person.
Brooke Shields, her new book is Brooke Shields is Not Allowed to Get Old, Thoughts on Aging as a Woman. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
This is NPR News.
There's a glut of new fiction titles coming out in the next couple months, among them a book called Dream State by Eric Puchner.
It's this real interesting meditation on marriage and on, like, male friendships and the sort of, like, what-ifs in life.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. We delve into a few upcoming releases, including what we know about the new Hunger Games book, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Crews are slowly making progress to contain the two largest wildfires burning in Southern California. The Eaton Fire near Pasadena is now 33% contained, according to CAL FIRE. Containment on the Palisades Fire burning between Santa Monica and Malibu is up to 14%. Working against fire crews will be stronger Santa Ana winds returning to the area this week. Forecasters say wind gusts could top 70 miles per hour. The fires are blamed for at least 24 deaths. That number could rise, with some people still unaccounted for. At least one Canadian tanker plane helping to fight the fire was damaged last week when it collided with a civilian drone being flown over the area illegally. Captain Mike Lawrence is with the LAPD. He says people will be prosecuted for flying drones over the fires.
The drones affect all of the aircraft then in the area. The aircraft needs to stop or cease what they're doing because the drones are up, and it creates a very immense safety hazard.
The Canadian Super Scooper is able to grab 1,500 gallons of ocean water to dump on the fires. It's not clear when Blue Origin will try again to launch its 320-foot New Glenn rocket. This morning's launch try in Florida was called off because of a technical issue. This is NPR News. A ban on THC, the psychoactive ingredient in cannabis, is expected to come before lawmakers in Texas this week. As John Burnett reports, a loophole in a state law has created a booming market in consumable cannabis, and conservative legislators are looking to close that.
Texas never intended to legalize recreational cannabis, but that's effectively what happened when the state passed a law 6 years ago to allow farmers to grow hemp for industrial purposes. Resourceful chemists and retailers found a way to take non-intoxicating hemp and extract products that get you high. Today, Texas has more than 7,000 cannabis dispensaries, even more than California. It's grown into a multi-billion dollar business with legions of loyal customers, including politically influential veterans who buy it to relieve PTSD. But the state's powerful lieutenant governor, Republican Dan Patrick, declared that he wants to ban THC altogether. Fans of consumable cannabis, from gummies to smokable flower, say it's too late to put the genie back in the bottle. For NPR News, I'm John Burnett in Austin.
Tonight's NFL wildcard playoff game between the Rams and the Minnesota Vikings has been moved from Los Angeles to Glendale, Arizona, because of the ongoing wildfires in Southern California. The game will be played at State Farm Stadium in Glendale. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. This is a crucial week in negotiations between Israel and Hamas.
Diplomats and officials from the U.S., Israel, and Hamas are all in Qatar, not all sitting in the same room, but close by. After 15 months of war, they're trying to be creative in getting some kind of agreement. The goal is to end the fighting and secure the release of Israeli hostages before President-elect Trump takes office on January 20th.
NPR's Daniel Estrin is on the line from Tel Aviv. So, Daniel, we mentioned people are trying to get creative here. How so?
Well, both the Biden administration and the incoming Trump administration are working together on this, which is unusual. And they both want the same thing. They want some kind of agreement before President Biden leaves office. Yesterday, Biden told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu there is an immediate need for a deal. And we've heard Trump many times say if the hostages are not released by his inauguration, there will be, quote, hell to pay. Biden's outgoing ambassador to Israel, Jack Lew, told me that Trump is driving the momentum here.
I think there's a certain fear of the unknown in terms of what the new administration will do and will say. And there's no daylight between, you know, the incoming administration and the outgoing administration in terms of wanting a hostage deal now and pressing all parties to make the concessions that are appropriate to reach that.
I spoke with an official with knowledge of the ongoing talks who's not authorized to speak publicly, but who said Trump's team has told Israel that by the inauguration, they want either a deal or a declaration of principles, which would be some kind of document that would, you know, lock the sides into a commitment toward a deal.
What would those principles be?
We do know the basic framework of the deal. Hamas would release around 33 Israeli hostages. A Palestinian official tells NPR this morning that Israel is discussing the release of more than 1,000 Palestinian detainees, including 22 people serving life sentences in connection with deadly attacks on Israelis, and those prisoners would be presumably exiled to Turkey, Qatar, or Egypt. And during all of this, there would be a six-week pause in fighting, there would be a surge of aid to Gaza, and more talks about the other hostages and trying to end the war.
Daniel, there have been talks before, so what are the chances of this one actually succeeding?
There is a lot of pressure on all the parties now to move forward. Qatar and Egypt, the two Arab mediators, want good relations with Trump, and so they're putting a lot of pressure on Hamas. A Hamas official not authorized to speak to the media told us that Hamas is trying to show flexibility and that it's proposed several different ways to try to resolve the points of contention. As for Israel, there's a key ally of Prime Minister Netanyahu, the finance minister, who is staunchly opposed to the deal as it's coming out now. But Israel does have motivation to cooperate with Trump on this. Israel wants his help with a couple of big things. It wants Trump's help to pursue diplomatic relations with Saudi Arabia, and it also wants Trump to potentially support an attack on Iran's nuclear program. So you do see that the talks have reached a crucial phase now. Israel's top security chiefs have traveled to Qatar this weekend to participate, and the president of the Red Cross has come to the region. The Red Cross was the group that facilitated the last hostage prisoner exchange.
That's NPR's Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv. Daniel, thank you.
You're welcome.
When the Los Angeles wildfires destroyed homes in recent days, they burned down some people's whole lives, which is especially hard for senior citizens. NPR's Kelly McEvers met some at a shelter.
The Westwood Rec Center was one of the first places to open up for people displaced by the Palisades fire. Inside, cots with Red Cross blankets are lined up in the gym for about 120 people. The Red Cross says three-quarters of them are seniors. Phil Brock and Kathy Boole came here to help serve lunch. He's 71, she's 75.
We're trying to help out as much as we can because so many people need help.
Kathy and Phil were able to evacuate to a hotel. So far, their houses are okay. Phil used to be the mayor of Santa Monica, right next to Pacific Palisades. He says older people already struggling with their health and mental health will struggle more. And the ones who lived in their homes for the longest stood to lose the most.
I was talking to a couple inside who lost their house. And as I leaned over to touch the mother's shoulder, I said, it's almost like you've lost the museum of your life. And she was like, yeah.
Then there are the people who didn't own their homes and don't know how to find a new rental, and older people who don't know how to get basic information.
One lady said, I don't know if the evacuation order has been lifted. How do I find out?
Sarah James is 76. She was staying with friends when the Palisades fire started Tuesday night. The friends evacuated. Sarah slept in her car. She saw the fire coming over the hill. Then the ash and smoke got bad.
When did you come here?
This is funny because of not sleeping, you lose track.
Yeah.
Yesterday?
Yeah.
But it seems, you know, a day becomes years long.
I realize Sarah James didn't have permanent housing before the fires. She stayed with people from church or in hotels. She says this is why she's not as attached to her stuff as other people. She would never say that to them. Sarah tells me to talk to her cot mate, Francoise Myra. She lived in her house in Pacific Palisades since she was four. She's 64 now. She says a friend told her when the fire started. At first, she wasn't worried.
And then I might have taken a little bit of a nap, but then, you know, about 4 o'clock, the fire had moved way east. And I could see it in the little space I had between the McMansions. And it was coming down the hill. And I'd never seen fire there before.
So Francoise left and came here. A few days later, her neighbor's son sent her a picture of the empty space where the neighbor's house used to be. She thinks that must mean her house is gone too.
I'm about 98% sure.
Now she says she doesn't know where to start. She has her phone, but she can't log into any of her accounts.
My password book is in ashes at home.
You wrote it down?
I wrote it all down. My password book was like 2 inches thick because I've been online since the 90s.
Right now, she's just focused on the things she can get done. Make sure she can keep her service dog, Puff. Other people were separated from their pets. Refill the 15 medications she takes every day. Get oxygen at night to treat her COPD. Take a shower. Find a comb. For NPR News, I'm Kelly McEvers in Los Angeles.
The kind of detail that brings it home. Our coverage of the LA wildfires continues today on All Things Considered with a look at how home insurance premiums could rise, not just for Californians in wildfire-prone areas, but for all homeowners in the state. Listen live on the NPR app or on your station, which brings you Morning Edition. This is NPR News.
Americans have a loneliness epidemic, so says the Surgeon General. Screens and social media are the problem, right? Well, a few apps claim to be a solution to connect people in real life. Friend making, next time here and now.
With everything from groceries to orthodontics, yes, really, available on demand, why not public radio? Make playing NPR or this station part of your smart speaker routine to stay informed on your schedule.
Good morning, I'm A. Martinez. After winning last year's U.S. Open, golfer Bryson DeChambeau won another challenge, hitting a hole-in-one over his house. He lives right by a golf course. He shared the challenge on his YouTube page, hitting one ball on day one, two on day two. On day 16, he finally sank it. Then he invited a fan to try for $100,000. He gave the fan 7 hours. It only took 5 swings.
Nathan!
Sounds like at worst, going over DeChambeau's house is what, a par two, par three? It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, for nearly a century, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at mott.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The solar power industry is about to take its rapid growth and find out what happens with a skeptical new president and Congress. Some homeowners are rushing to install panels on the roofs while they can. NPR's Jeff Brady reports.
In the Boston suburbs, Jorge Solares decided last summer to install solar panels on his house, both for the environment and to save money.
We have a brand new baby, and we're hoping to make that investment. So at some point, we're going to have to pay electricity and focus on her spending.
Solares expects the panels will reduce his electric bill and pay for themselves in 5 or 6 years. It took a few months for inspections, permits, and installing the panels. Then Donald Trump won the election.
Looking ahead, I just don't know what to expect from the next administration.
During the campaign, Trump vowed to rescind unspent funds under President Biden's climate-focused Inflation Reduction Act. It's not clear yet what that could mean. Trump's campaign didn't respond to an interview request. Currently, there's a 30% federal tax credit for rooftop solar. That saved Solaris $8,000.
Since we're spending so much money on this, the federal credit was just the way for us to get it. We needed that. Otherwise, it's just too expensive.
Given uncertainty about the future of the tax credit, Solaris pushed the installer to get the panels hooked up before the end of 2024 to ensure he can claim the credit on last year's taxes. Near Jacksonville, Florida, Jeff Beersley says because of uncertainty over the tax credit, he reached a different conclusion.
A big part of me wanted to lean towards solar.
He was deliberating between installing solar panels plus batteries or a gas generator to keep power on in his house after a hurricane.
I certainly liked being able to generate my own power from the sun. You know, that's kind of cool from a sustainability perspective.
Solar power is more climate friendly than a fossil fuel generator, which releases climate warming greenhouse gases. But Beardsley couldn't get panels operating by the end of the year, and potentially losing the 30% tax credit prompted him to choose the gas generator. Companies that install solar panels say this uncertainty is affecting their business.
How are you? Hey, good to meet you in person.
Yes,
thanks for doing this.
In the Philadelphia suburbs, Doug Edwards leads me to the warehouse for his company, Exact Solar.
As you can see, we are packed to the gills here.
He stocked up on solar panels because of another uncertainty. He's worried Trump will raise tariffs on imported panels. If that happens quickly, between when a job is bid and when it's finished, that could make a project unprofitable. By stocking up, Edwards has locked in panel prices for future bids. Beyond that, Edwards says he made business plans assuming current incentives would be in place for a decade.
We've almost tripled in size in the last few years, all local hiring, all local team members, and we're just hopeful that we won't have to slow that down or have that disrupted in a major way.
Solar industry trade groups are focused on policies aligned with Republicans, boosting domestic manufacturing, limiting imports, and creating jobs. Stephen Irvin with Amicus Solar Cooperative makes another point that it's a mistake to see solar power as more aligned with Democrats.
And our companies and our membership are spread across red and blue districts. We've got multiple members in Republican districts. So solar is not just a Democratic issue. It's an American issue.
The solar industry hopes President Trump and Republicans in Congress will come to see it that way, too, and leave subsidies in place that encourage more homeowners to install solar power. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez.
latest on the fires.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishor, in for David Brancaccio. Los Angeles is starting the week with the prospect of strengthening winds and increasing fire danger, even as firefighters continue to battle flames that have already destroyed so many communities. 24 people have died. That number has been rising and could continue to rise. We're also getting new information on the number of homes destroyed, new estimates on the likely economic costs, and new policies to help with the eventual rebuilding. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has more.
In Los Angeles, 62 square miles, an area larger than all of San Francisco, has already burned. Inspectors have fanned out into neighborhoods to survey the destruction. Their task is urgent because it helps move the insurance claims process along. Meanwhile, California Governor Gavin Newsom over the weekend issued an executive order suspending certain permitting requirements to speed up reconstruction when the time comes. Newsom spoke on NBC's Meet the Press.
We've got to let people know we have their back. We're going to be back. We're going to do it efficiently and effectively because we want you to come back, rebuild, and rebuild with higher quality building standards, more modern standards. And we want to make sure that the associated costs with that are not disproportionate.
To that end, Newsom extended price gouging protections on things like construction and building materials and tasked state agencies with finding more ways to speed up permitting. Of the two largest fires, officials now estimate that some 12,000 structures, homes, and businesses have been destroyed or damaged. So far, inspectors have confirmed 2,500 are destroyed. The final price tag won't be known for a while, but AccuWeather estimates economic losses of up to $150 billion. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
President-elect Donald Trump's staff and Republican members of Congress are getting ready for day one of the new administration. They're preparing both executive orders and legislation for the president-elect to sign as soon as he takes office. As Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports, immigration is likely to be an early priority.
Some of the early moves of the incoming Trump White House will be in response to the moves of the outgoing Biden White House, says Kathleen Bush Joseph, a policy analyst at the Migration Policy Institute.
So I think that we can expect the Trump administration to be rolling back a lot of what the Biden administration put in place.
Like expansions of temporary protected status for certain groups. Meanwhile, Congress is teeing up a controversial bill that would require detentions of undocumented people accused of crimes like theft or shoplifting, even if they haven't had a day in court yet. Doug LaGore is with the RAND Corporation's Homeland Security Research Division.
The other sections of the statute have to do with states' attorneys general being able to essentially sue the federal government for releasing certain types of individuals from detention.
Which LaGore says would be pretty unprecedented. Republicans making these moves early sends a clear message, says Sarah Goodman, who teaches political science at UC Irvine.
What we're seeing here, even before Trump takes office, is immigration is not just a talking point. Republican leaders are very serious about delivering for their base.
And the election revealed immigration is very much a top issue for the GOP base. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
All right, let's do the numbers. The Dow is up 180 points. That is 0.4%. The S&P 500 is down 0.4%. The NASDAQ is down more than a full percent.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Palo Alto Networks. Palo Alto Networks delivers what's next in cybersecurity innovation to protect today's digital way of life. Learn more at paloaltonetworks.com.
Self-employed people that send and receive payments for their work using things like PayPal, Venmo, Cash App, they get a special tax form, something called a 1099-K, but they only get it if they make at least $20,000. Now, the threshold has been lowered, and a lot more people could find one of those forms in their mailbox, even if they are not self-employed. Mark Sieber is with Jackson Hewitt Tax Service. He spoke with my Marketplace colleague, David Brancaccio.
If a person does contract work for pay, you've always had to report your income at tax time. But what is this 1099-K? I have not seen that one before.
The 1099-K has been around for a long time, and it was used primarily for payments made through any third-party app like, you know, Venmo or PayPal. The reason you hadn't heard about it was because until this year, the threshold was pretty high for when one of those third-party platforms had to send a 1099-K to both the recipient of the monies and to the IRS.
All right, we're going to clear this up. What is it for this tax year that we're concerned about, which is 2024? It's like $5,000, right?
It is $5,000. They've considered it a transition year, so they've gone from $20,000 last year to tax year 24, the year you'll be doing your taxes here in a few weeks, to $5,000. Now, for tax year 26, the threshold is $600. And to be clear, those are locked in stone as the rule. So if you got PayPal money or Venmo money over $5,000, then you might get a 1099-K. Now, that's per platform. So if you use multiple platforms, you don't add them all together. It's $5,000 on that platform.
But not Zelle. This is a Zelle exemption?
Well, Zelle does not consider themselves a third-party platform, and whether you get one or don't get one, or whether you're doing side hustle business and getting paid this way, it's always been taxable.
What if you're selling an old sofa, an old lampshade, and it does accumulate, and it is more than $5,000? Could you get one of these for just selling stuff?
Absolutely. There's no rule because it's, you know, a hobby or a side gig or part-time. If you're getting paid, unfortunately, it's a taxable gain, even if it's a dollar.
What about if my rich Aunt Sally sends me $400 on PayPal to get me through the month? How about that situation?
You know, if you've got a gift or a payment, those are completely not taxable. And furthermore, you should not get that on a 1099-K. That being said, if you didn't fill out the platform activity correctly and you didn't put personal payments and they send you a 1099-K, you can either get an amended 1099 by asking the platform, or the IRS in their infinite wisdom have figured out how to put it on your tax return on a line and back it off on another line. But you can't ignore it if you get one, because the IRS has it too, and they may not have all the facts and knowledge that you have.
Mark Stieber, Senior Vice President, also Chief Tax Information Officer at Jackson Hewitt Tax Service. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and have a great tax season.
In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.